Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each episode to post some thoughts to help us get a conversation going about a viable and helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. And again, I want to thank all of you who have commented or asked questions. I will often integrate those comments into future episodes and will definitely gather them into the book that I'm going to write at the end of the project. Now, in this second section of the project, we're asking a question. Does religion have anything to offer our society's current quest for a viable curriculum for sex education? Does religion have anything to offer in this area? Now, in these first few episodes of the second section, before we can talk about anything religion would have to offer, we're looking at where we've gone wrong, how we lost our moral authority on the topic. So let's begin with this episode. It's called Christian Sexuality, We Really Owe Folks an Apology. Now, in the last episode, we saw a fundamental shift that happened to Christianity when the epicenter of our faith moved from Jerusalem to Rome. We saw how trying to tell the Christian story to Greco-Romans started a process, planted a seed, that in this episode we'll see grew and grew over time. The seed was a devaluation of the physicality of the world. We saw how, in Plato's three-tier universe, the least valuable layer was the physical world that you and I inhabit. And nothing is much more physical than our sexuality. We saw how sex got dirty, and in this episode we'll see how dirty sex metastasized through the following years. Under the influence of the Platonic worldview through the centuries, Western Christianity became increasingly antagonistic toward sex. The early trajectory we saw in the last episode has been plaguing us ever since. Like a virus, sometimes latent, sometimes active, the devaluation of physicality and of bodies and of sexuality crops up again and again. So, for centuries, we've stumbled and lurched forward, sometimes accessing deep wisdom about sexuality, but at other times, all in a twist on the subject. Sometimes we see with rich clarity, and we have a profound wisdom to offer. But many times our vision is clouded by our history. We swing like a pendulum, returning to harsh suppression of our sexuality and then reacting to our own suppression. Now, in this episode, we'll look at how our Platonic legacy has affected us, and in particular, the church leaders in the first few centuries of the church. Under the influence of the Greco-Roman worldview, we held a pretty dim view of sexuality. And as the centuries kept rolling along, that legacy just kept coming back to haunt us. Let's begin with Augustine. Augustine was one of the most influential early church leaders. In the 5th century, he was a bishop in what's now Algeria, a Roman province of North Africa at the time. He himself had been influenced by church leaders from earlier centuries, but by the 5th century, he summed up the Western Christian view of sexuality in a way that still affects us today. He became the spokesman for this way of thinking. Drawing from those earlier leaders from the few centuries before him, here's what he wrote. There are only four Christian options for sex. First, and this is the best option, Christians should remain virgins permanently forever. Second, if you have been sexually active in the past, you should stop, and you should stay stopped. In other words, you should remain celibate for the rest of your life. Third option, if you just can't contain yourself, okay, you can go ahead and have sex, but you can only do it for the purpose of bringing children into your family. So in other words, you've got to be married, and you've got to have sex, but only for the purpose of creating children. You do not do it for pleasure. You do not do it for love. You only do it to make babies. And fourth, you can have sex for love, you can have sex for pleasure, only with your spouse, but when you do, you will be committing a sin. Now, the nice thing is, he said, is that married people sex is not a serious sin. He called it a venial sin. That means it's one of the easily forgiven sins. It only takes a little bit of prayer or a little bit of repentance to take care of that sin. So those were Augustine's four options: permanent virginity, permanent celibacy, a little bit of sex, but only for making babies, or a little bit of sin. Now, anything other than those four, he said, and now we're talking about serious sin, mortal sin, not a venial sin, mortal sin was the word he used. That was the kind of sin, he insisted, that would get you consigned to outer darkness. That was his term, consigned to outer darkness. So yeah, I think most people would agree that's a pretty dim view of sex. But the sad thing is, it was pretty representative of most Christian leaders after our religion migrated from Jerusalem to Rome. As we said, sex got dirty, and Plato's universe became the Christian universe. One of the earlier leaders from which Augustine got those ideas was a second century philosopher and theologian. His name was Clement of Alexandria. So he was way back in the second century. Now, he was both a classical teacher of Greek philosophy and a Christian bishop. So he had one foot in the Platonic worldview, and he had the other foot trying to help people live the Christian life. And he was one of the very first to make sex so dirty. And it was from him that Augustine first heard the four sex options. But Clement not only dirtied up sex, he initiated another toxic theme. And that was this, that female sexuality is dirtier than male sexuality. Women, he said, are dangerous. Women, he said, are lusty creatures. Now, I don't think many of these early leaders were married men. History doesn't tell us if Clement was or not, but most married men I know who were in a long-term sexual relationship with a woman, they might dispute Clement's view of which of the genders is the more lusty one. But anyway, perhaps uninformed by real-life experience, Clement insisted that women have no restraint on their sex drives. They don't, he said, even have the good sense that animals have. At least animals, he said, once they conceive, they know not to indulge their mates in any more of this sinful sexual behavior. Women, some early Christian leaders taught us, are so sexed up that they will suck hapless and virtuous males into the sin of sexual desire, and it will happen every time. So be careful, men. Stay away. Be on guard, because female sexuality is dangerous. He really taught that stuff. And these early Christian ideas have acutely influenced our religion's history. Early on, we begin to espouse the whole dirty sex ideology and the whole women denigrating ideology. Women's sex, we taught, is greedy, insatiable, and base. Sex is dirty, and female sex is the dirtiest of all. Now, this podcast isn't about the denigration of women in Christian history, but since we're here, if we're going to be honest in our assessment of our own history, debasing women has been a recurring theme. On this point, we really do owe Western civilization an apology. Our early leaders taught that men are rational and moral and intellectual, and they taught that women are irrational, immoral, and ruled by emotion. And of course, they believed that emotion was an inferior human trait. They taught that women are naturally inferior to men because they were bishops. They had God Says to back them up. That's what bishops get to draw from. So women's inferiority, they said, was due in large part to their sexuality, because lady sex is dirtier than gentleman sex. Now, by the way, when we turn this podcast into a book, I'll footnote this part and point you to an article that you may want to read. You can Google it now. The title is this. It's a long one. The Servant of the Devil, The Demonization of Female Sexuality in the Medieval Patristic Discourse. Now, if you Google that, and if you have a library card, you can read it online. So forward fast now, about 800 to 1,000 years from Clement. By this time, dirty sex has been stewing in the Christian tradition for a while. So by the time the medieval theologians begin to work on it, they begin to rethink the meaning of the whole Genesis account in light of dirty sex. Thinking about the human condition in general, they naturally went back to our narrative of origin, the Genesis story. Now, what they were puzzling over is how sin had crept into human history and how it had crept into the human condition. And as they were working things out, kind of telling the story and retelling it and trying to figure out how best to tell it, dirty sex was afforded a place in the retelling of the Genesis story. The fall of humanity, they reasoned, that event that if infected the human heart, well, that is bad. And sexual desire, as our early Christian and Platonic leaders taught us, that is also bad. So, they figured, those two bad things are probably related to each other. So, by the Middle Ages, the second chapter of Genesis, the part that talks about eating the apple, shifted from being a story just about humanity's struggle with sin to a story about dirty sex. and in particular a story about dirty female sex, because they said Eve was the culprit in the fall of humanity. She was the temptress. She was the one who got humanity into this fix, and she did it with her seductive sexual allure. The fall of humanity, the sin nature every human being struggles with, we got it from dirty sex. We got it from dirty female sex. Eve seduced Adam, medieval theologians reasoned, and sexual sin became the driver behind all human badness. Well, poor sex. That's a lot of blame to have to carry. Everything that's bad about the human condition, war and murder and genocide and hatred and vice, it's all sex's fault, and mostly it's lady sex's fault. So I imagine they were doing the best they could with what they had to work with, and what they had to work with was the Platonic worldview interpreted and reinterpreted by some early male Greco-Roman theologians, and they were trying to make sense in a physical world that had been debased by Platonic thinking, and they were trying to make sense of a world where debased sex was the accepted view. They were trying to tell a story that made sense of Eve's guilt and every woman after her, which, since our early church leaders were exclusively men, well, this was pretty convenient for them to tell the story this way. As I was getting this episode ready, thinking about how dirty sex has metastasized through the centuries, I remembered a book I read in college. It was Victor Hugo's book, Hunchback of Notre Dame. Dirty sex was infecting the church all the way into the 1800s when Hugo wrote the book. After my second year at university, I decided I wasn't going to be a dentist after all, and I took a year off, and I worked, and I took classes at a local junior college. And early in that year, I stumbled on a list called 100 Books Every Person Should Read Before They Graduate School. And Victor Hugo was on the list, and Les Miserables was on the list. And that was a powerful, moving book for me. I loved how richly he wrote about the human condition. So rather than going to the next book on the list, I picked up several of Victor Hugo's novels, including The Hunchback. Now, it's a richly layered story, and it has a lot of important themes in it, and I bet some readers would disagree with the interpretation I'm about to give you. But for this podcast, here's what I think the book is about. I think the book is about a sexually repressed priest. He's the Archbishop of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, and his experience has led this poor guy to inherit 1,600 years of dirty sex. He inherited Clement. He inherited Augustine. He inherited the whole thing. And as a devout man, he worked hard to do what good priests, what good Christians should do. He suppressed his sexual hunger. That's what he was taught. He pushed down his libido. He tried hard to rise above his animal sexual instincts. He was a good man, a devout man, a righteous man, doing what good, devout, righteous men are supposed to do. But if you've read the story, you don't think of him as a good man at all. You don't think of him as devout or righteous at all. In fact, you think of him as the villain in the story. You think of him as hypocritical or mean-spirited or harsh or sinister, and he was that. But I think he was that because he had suppressed the joyous, expansive, energetic passion that drives our humanity. The sexual journey that so powerfully shapes our religious journey, he had no access to it because his religion had forced him to push down and drive underground and quash and overpower and conquer his sexuality. But that part of us, that deep resident part we call sexuality, is such a deep part of our humanity that try as we might, it will not die. For it to die, our very souls would die. So for this priest, this archbishop, it just kept cropping up. And for him, it cropped up in his attraction, his love for, his admiration of the beautiful Esmeralda. But whenever his attraction would arise, the priest hated it inside of himself. He whipped that sexual attraction down. He drove it away. He denied it. He denied himself even the non-erotic expression of love and attraction that he had for her, so much so that in the end he became embittered and hostile and vicious, the very antithesis of love, the very antithesis of the expansiveness of soul. He saw the thing that we saw in part one, how this journey moves us to become bigger and bigger people. He denied that to himself. By inheriting our tradition's infected, dirty view of sex, this archbishop could not access the growth that is available to both celibate people and sexually active people when they walk the full sexual journey. And so he hated. And in his hatred, he organized the death of Esmeralda. Dirty sex doesn't serve us well. Dirty sex gets us into trouble. Dirty sex is not the sex of the Bible. If we're going to excavate the wisdom treasure that our tradition has to offer, and if we're going to bring that wisdom into a discussion of healthy sexual education curriculum for our young people, we have to know about this infection that we have carried for so long. Now today, very few church folks are overt about the dirtiness of sex. In fact, this last 50 years or so, we've worked hard to celebrate sexuality. We do seminars about happy, healthy, uninhibited sex for married folks. And when we tell our young people to wait for sex, we emphasize what a beautiful, wonderful thing they're waiting for. Clement and Augustine and our early church leaders, they have fallen into disfavor these days. Only a small minority would say any longer that sex is only for making babies. However, our heritage is old, and it is deep, and it still affects us. Now it just affects us more covertly. It's more subtext than it is direct message. Sex and shame are still traveling companions, and even though the shame is more subtle, it's still there. Gender stratification still lingers in our Christian instincts. Women are still diminished. Dirty sex still affects us, but now it's sneaky. It's gone underground. It's gone underground, but it's still there. And here again, we really do owe Western civilization an apology. But even more so, we owe ourselves an honest assessment of where we went wrong and where we still go wrong. We need to see where and how our past catches up with us. Now, our generation has the benefit of hindsight. We're able to critique the Greco-Roman worldview. We have a bigger picture, and we can stand back and see how we got sucked into our unhelpful sex narrative. We can see the negative ways it still impacts us. But to begin the healing process, we have to name what it is that went wrong. We have to see how it impacted us. We have to step back from those toxic instincts because, as we'll see in the remainder of this podcast, we have some jewels of wisdom to offer. We really have a baby in there with all that bathwash. We have something to offer to this discussion of healthy sexuality. All right, we'll pick up here next episode. And as always, I hope you'll comment. I hope you share your insights. Many of us have been impacted by the unhelpful undercurrents of the sexual curriculum we were given in our Christian lives. I hope you'll join the conversation, share what you've learned from your experience.